added $862 million in disaster relief. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
The Dom Salvia Show.
Musk is so arrogant that he is even intervening right here in the state of Wisconsin.
Republican Rep. Brian Stile said in a statement that Sanders was on a fear-mongering tour. Maybe you should be afraid when billionaires can buy the presidency, when billionaires can buy elections. I think that's a little scary.
And I think so.
We the people should do something about it.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
Nothing you could say could tear me away from my dog. My dog is shallow, y'all. Hi, I'm Smokey Robinson. When you adopt a shelter pet, you not only bring joy and love into your home, you also give another animal the chance to experience that special bond. Join me in supporting American Humane Society and their incredible work to help our most vulnerable friends. Together, we can make a real difference. Donate today at AmericanHumane.org.
The Todd Alba Show.
Let's go to Ollie in the North Woods. Ollie, hiccups or gas, what's worse?
Well, I'd like to frame my answer in the form of a sport. It depends upon whether you're a passer or a receiver.
That's great. Whether you're the passer or the receiver, that's the best line of the day.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Out here in the middle of these acres, it can feel like you're the only person on earth. That's how it feels when you're struggling with your mental health. But you don't have to feel alone. Find more information at loveyourmindtoday.org. Brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. Folks, we've got to talk about Derek Van Orden. The second-term congressman representing Wisconsin's 3rd District is at it again, dodging public meetings and making all kinds of unhinged comments. As many scramble and struggle to understand the chaos of what's happening in Washington, D.C. and how it's impacting people here in Wisconsin, Van Orden has been as frustrating and disrespectful as ever. In one instance, Van Orden took to social media to berate a veteran who had been fired from his job at the VA by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. And the veteran in question is simply someone who was just reaching out to his congressman, looking for answers. Van Orden's office has also hastily canceled public meetings, and he has made some especially wild accusations about people who have been attending these public events. Congressman Van Orden needs to stop this unhinged madness, and more importantly, be more available and accountable to his constituents.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tome Olson. Wisconsin's Supreme Court race is technically nonpartisan, but the lines are drawn. Elon Musk has put millions into Brad Schimmel's campaign. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
Musk's company, Tesla, is suing the state for denying its request for dealers' licenses, a case that could reach the high court. University of Wisconsin-Madison professor Michael Wagner says the state's rule about justices making their own decisions about when to recuse themselves from cases makes the election outcome that much more consequential.
It's in a presidential swing state, it's on a swing court, and the cases that are going to come before the court are going to be cases where the donors in the election, most notably Elon Musk, have a clear interest and a clear path they want the winning judge to take.
Judge Susan Crawford of Dane County has been called out for receiving campaign money from Democratic billionaire George Soros and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. Spending on this race is expected to top the historic $56 million spent on the last state Supreme Court race. Millions have been spent on ads to sway undecided voters. A recent Marquette University poll found many say they still don't know enough about each candidate. But he notes some of the ads egregiously misrepresent the candidates, like a Schimmel campaign ad that featured the wrong Susan Crawford.
We live in this environment where it's just easier to take the shortcut that feels good in the moment, even if it's not true, even if it isn't good for the long-term project of living together and governing together as citizens.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Brandon Bormans. A nice start to the weekend, bit of a different finish though. Sunny skies today with a high near 41. For tonight, increasing clouds, a light mix possible late, a low near 32. Rainy and breezy on Sunday with a high temperature near 50. Right now, it's 28 degrees.
John Peterson and Gordy Young.
On our next show, we'll talk to Wes and Lori from the Western Dane Democracy Project.
And you'll get a double dose of John and Gordy. We'll be on for Maggie Dawn from 2 to 4.
Join us.
The John and Gordy Show, weekday mornings 6 till 8. A voice for Madison. Real news and great conversation. 92.7 WMDX. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel. I'm your host for this broadcast on the broadcast stations of Civic Media throughout the state of Wisconsin and beyond. I am joined in the Civic Media studio this weekend by my excellent producer, Max. And together, as always, we are soliciting, we are encouraging your questions, your inquiries, your comments, your perspectives about things on our ambitious, but as always, achievable agenda, our syllabus this weekend. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining Max and me once again for our discussion of all things rule of law related, justice related, government related, and we've got a lot of it this weekend to talk about. It once again has been a busy week in the area of rule of law issues, and we're going to use this opportunity, as promised in our previous broadcast, also to initiate at least one, maybe even two new segments. The one that we're certainly going to initiate this weekend is called Injunction Function. And yes, it's perhaps a throwback to things you may recall from your youth having to do with language on the television. This is going to be all about highlighting, as we promised in our previous broadcast, and going in depth on some of the most significant cases pending right now in the federal district courts, in some cases, appeals courts, having to do with challenges against these many executive orders in all sorts of areas issued by the President of the United States of America, his name, Donald Trump. We're going to spend some time talking about the function of the federal courts, receiving and resolving challenges to many, if not all, of these executive orders. We spend some time doing a little law school this weekend, talking about what an injunction is. We're going to talk about what a TRO is, a temporary restraining order, how that works, what a preliminary injunction is, what a permanent injunction is, just because it's important to understand the process, the procedure of what's going on in these many cases. And yes, indeed, as we have commented in the past, and as everyone, regardless of what side of the political aisle you are on these days, everyone commenting that it is a lot. There is a lot going on, a lot to understand in trying to make sense of what is going on in our federal courts, frankly, our other courts around the nation, and what's going on in government. How is government responding? And as we have talked again on this broadcast in the past, rule of law issues about compliance, whether or not the words, the commission, the directive, the orders of federal judges are obeyed, are followed, are pursued by the other branches of government. What in fact happens if indeed a president says, no, I'm not going to do what a federal court judge has commanded, ordered me to do? We'll talk not only about that horrific implication, and yes, indeed, that is getting right up to, if not crossing into, the area of, yes, indeed, a constitutional crisis, a word that perhaps phrase bandied about much too much these days, but now coming upon it. Because what does it mean? It means we've come to the end of the constitutional process. There's no more check and no more balance. The entire system, our entire system, including federal judges issuing injunctions, issuing TROs, is premised upon the fundamental notion. This is Madisonian democracy. This is what a republic is premised upon. All of this depended upon other branches of government abiding by, and yes, sometimes challenging, the orders, the directives, the legislation of another branch, but always following in such a way that there is another remedy, there's another avenue to pursue. If, in fact, any of those branches, we know there are three of them, there's a judicial branch, sometimes referred to as the weakest branch of government, we'll think more about that. There is the executive branch, obviously intended by James Madison and others to execute on the laws issued, proposed, and put into law by the first branch of government, which is the legislature, obviously with the signature of the president as well. Those are the three branches of government, and checks and balances between those three branches are what keep us from anarchy. What happens if one of those branches says we're not participating anymore? We're not going to abide by the directions of a fellow branch of government. That is indeed when the constitutional process, our Constitution contemplates the making of laws plainly, as do our founding documents. When, in fact, you come to the end of that, that is when the crisis is afoot. And that is when a republic, as Sonia Sotomayor and others have commented just about 8 months or so ago, that's when our republic is in danger. That's when she and others have fear for the future of our nation. We're going to talk about all of that in the context of what judges do when it comes to injunctive relief. We're calling this, once again, injunction function. Because we're talking about the function of the federal courts. What do they do? How do they do this? And how do we make sense of these many cases that are right now pending in federal courts around the country? We're going to focus necessarily, again, as promised in the past, on five, count them, five cases, all of which, every single one of these in the courts just in this past week. What are those cases? We're going to spend some time necessarily talking about cases involving everything from an attempt by the EPA to recoup huge amounts of money given out under the previous administration to address climate issues. We're going to talk about the transgender troop ban imposed by the president just a day or so into his presidency. We're going to talk about the Social Security Administration and this attempt by the Musk team. Notice I'm not calling it Doge, and I will not call it Doge because the D of Doge is a department, and it is not a department. It is not. We're going to call it the Trump team, the Musk team, probably the Trump team as well, the Trump team, the Musk team, attempting to gain access to Social Security information. We'll talk about what a federal district court judge did in that case. We'll talk about USAID funding and the shuttering of that agency and what another federal district court judge did just this past week. And first and foremost, we're going to talk about the case that's on the mind and, yes, the hearts of everybody right now. That is the case involving those Venezuelan immigrants who are now in a high-security prison in El Salvador. We'll talk about what a judge in the District of Columbia has done just in hours ago, just in his processing, his administration of that case. Those five of them, deep dives in what's going on, not only to understand them, but also to underscore the role that judges play, the functional role that they play in imposing initially these TROs, these temporary restraining orders, then moving on to preliminary injunctions, and perhaps one day moving on to permanent injunctions. And we'll talk about all of that and what the word injunction means, actually. That is the first and principal part of our syllabus, our agenda for Amicus, a law review in this, principally the first, but probably also a portion of our second hour on this weekend. Necessarily, coming off of my comments about the interrelationship between the branches of government, we need to talk about something else that happened this week, and that is this low-level sparring very low level, not especially aggressive on either side. But John Roberts especially, being very tepid when it comes to pushing back on the president of the United States, who suggested that some of these judges, at least one of them named James Boasberg, he's the D.C. judge in the case involving the Venezuelan immigrants, should be impeached. We'll hear what John Roberts said in a very tepid response. We'll hear what Donald Trump is saying also in response to that, suggesting along the way that time is of the essence, talking about what may happen if indeed something happens before it's too late. Those were his comments just this past week. We'll talk about that spat between branches of government and what more should actually be going on, what more the American public should be hearing properly if we had a fully robust judicial branch here, at least with respect to the Supreme Court, that would say that no, indeed, there's more than just impeachment threats going on here from the president, but also push back on this president and his comments about the judiciary that undermine the very understandings about what judges do in America. We're necessarily also going to talk about what our attorney general, the chief federal law enforcement officer in our nation, appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the United States Senate. You know, her name is Pamela Bondi. She used to be the attorney general of Florida. She has been our attorney general since the first weeks of this administration. We will talk about the stunning things that she has said. Yes, also in this political arena, we will forgive. We will forgive a lot of things that are said by members of Congress, by the president, by other members of the executive branch, falling in the category of partisan and political statements. Not from our attorney general, not from Pam Bondi, and yet she did it. She has talked about the obligation, the requirement that the executive branch do what it wants to do absent any judicial oversight. And speaking specifically about the Boasberg decisions, that Venezuelan immigration case, stunning things to say, stunning rejections of the very notions upon which our government has been built, our republic has been premised. Our attorney general, the chief federal law enforcement officer in our nation, giving us a lesson in civics that is unknown in 250 years. And contrary, I would offer, to everything that she has been taught at the Stetson Law School, which is the law school from which she graduated in Florida. Interesting to go back to that law school and ask if the dean, if the provost of that school would embrace the things that she said about the capacity of one branch to say no to another. To say no, indeed, we don't have to follow what a judge, as she said, an unelected, singular federal judge telling us what to do. Our attorney general saying she doesn't have to follow that. The president doesn't have to follow that. Undermining, turning on its head, again, well over two centuries of understandings about our system of justice and the rules by which we operate in this nation. All of that coming up. And finally, time permitting, we're also going to talk about some studies in capitulation, which have also been animating our news this past week. Capitulation by, yes, very recently, Columbia University, and yes, indeed, a law firm, a big law firm called Paul Weiss. Both of those entities, under different circumstances, capitulating to the executive branch, capitulating to the president when it comes to his wanting to stop their activities, wanting them to engage in behavior, and doing it principally by virtue of executive threats to shut down a major portion of Columbia University, $400 million in funding, and to shut down Paul Weiss by virtue of telling them they can't get access to federal courts and federal buildings, other mechanisms attempting to push back on our academic institutions and our law firms and lawyers, as we've talked about before. All of that and more. It's a lot coming up on this edition of Amicus Law Review. Stay with us for all of that important discussion here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
A new choice. Madison's real news and great conversation. 92.7 WMDX.
I'm still going for it, even with higher stroke risk from atrial fibrillation and a regular heartbeat not caused by a heart valve problem. Over a three-year study, Eliquis apixaban tablets reduced stroke risk better than warfarin. And over 97% of Eliquis patients did not experience a stroke. A first stroke occurred in 2.9% of warfarin patients versus 2.3% of Eliquis patients.
Don't stop taking prescription Eliquis without asking your doctor. It may increase your stroke risk. Eliquis can cause serious and, in rare cases, fatal bleeding. Don't take Eliquis if you have an artificial heart valve, abnormal bleeding, or antiphospholipid syndrome. While taking, you may bruise more easily or take longer for bleeding to stop. A spinal injection while on Eliquis increases risk of blood clots, which may cause paralysis, the inability to move. Get medical help right away for unexpected bleeding, unusual bruising, or tingling, numbness, or muscle weakness. Medications such as aspirin products, NSAIDs, SSRIs, SNRIs, and blood thinners may increase bleeding risk. Tell your doctor about all planned medical or dental procedures. Learn more at Eliquis.com or call 1-855-ELIQUIS.
Welcome to Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
This is Amicus Law Review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. My name is James Santel. I am your host this hour as well as next hour. As always, amicus, meaning friend. Amicus curiae, friend of the court. The concept, the idea, we take our name from the Latin, from the legal term as well, being a friend to the community, providing information, insight, perspective, that is balanced and reasonable. You can disagree with policies. You can disagree with what judges do, what our legislature does, what our president does. But we need to have a fundamental understanding of how this works, the basic terms and conditions, the processes, the policies by which all of these institutions of government work. And to that end, in this first portion of our broadcast this week, and we're going to spend some time doing a little bit of law school, as we sometimes do, talking about injunctive relief. What does that mean? What does a judge do when he or she imposes an injunction? We'll do some of that as we begin our examination of five different cases in which judges have enjoined the executive branch from doing what it wants to do under these executive orders. All of that, inviting your conversation, your comments. As always, the phone number here at Civic Media is 855-752-4842, 855-752-4842. You can call in. Max and I will take your call. You can also drop a comment, a question to the studio chat, and we'll acknowledge and respond to that as well. Be a part of our discussion, which again begins now. With a bit of law school here on the weekend, necessary to understanding what five different judges, all of them federal district court judges, have done just in the past week, issuing injunctions of various natures with respect to what Donald Trump and the administration is attempting to do in five very different areas of our lives and our livelihoods. Let's talk about what all this means. What is an injunction? What does that mean to enjoin something? Well, the simple way of thinking about it is it's to stop something. An injunction in many situations is a circumstance where someone runs into court and says something very bad is about to happen. Most often when I was in law school, the easy way to understand this from my professors had to get through my brain would explain, what if there's a fire going on? What if there's a flood that's imminent? What if a dam is about to break? What if something else is about to happen and you can't wait? You can't wait for that thing to happen before you get a trial on the merits, which could take days, weeks, sometimes even years. What do you need to do to stop the bad thing from happening? In many cases, injunctions can also be affirmative in nature. It's not just stopping something. Maybe it could also be, and here's the double negative, could also be stopping someone or an entity from not doing something. You add those two knots together, it requires the government in some way, a particular private party, to act affirmatively in some way. It is a directive from the court faced with a circumstance that needs some immediate attention. Something bad is going to happen. That at least would be the petition of the challengers saying, Judge, help us out. Make certain that this bad thing does not happen and keep it in place. We often talk about the status quo, right? Keep these things in place so that we can come in and argue with you and argue to you and argue against the other side about the merits of our claim that we need to stop this permanently. But right now, stop this thing from happening, whatever that may be. In the particular cases that we're going to spend some time talking about, it has to do with orders of the executive branch.
that are indeed affecting people's livelihood when it comes to employment, affecting the engagement of our nation overseas entities, affecting access to Social Security information, the capacity of transgender troops to serve our nation, the capacity of people to get monies which they were given to ensure the safety and security of our environment going forward. The safety and security of our people when it comes to actions undertaken by the president under a centuries-old statute. All of that in the category of requests for injunctive relief. And again, as you will see, as we talk about these cases, in each one of them, you have got private parties, sometimes former government officials, coming into court and saying something bad has happened. Judge, put in place an injunctive order, preliminary in nature, temporary in nature, to stop this from happening, stop the bleeding, stop the damage from happening. And then we'll come back and when we've got a bit more time and explain to you why that preliminary injunction, that temporary restraining order, should be expanded into a larger scope. And that's where we begin once again. What is happening in virtue of all of these cases is when these judges are confronted, sometimes, as we know, just in the most significant, most timely of these cases, quite literally a week ago when we were on the air last weekend, this was breaking, coming into Judge James Boasberg's court. A request from private parties, private individuals to stop the government, our government, the United States government, from sending overseas to El Salvador hundreds of Venezuelan immigrants. Coming into Judge Boasberg's court, yes, indeed, on a Saturday. As a footnote, our attorney general has bemoaned the fact, believe it or not, that the courts are somehow open on the weekends and that her attorneys are required to go in and defend against these things on a weekend. Well, Madam Attorney General, once again, whether a U.S. attorney, attorney general, you are in those positions 24 hours a day. It's outrageous that you would suggest that somehow justice is suspended during a weekend and that the very petition running into Judge Boasberg's court was untimely somehow because it happened on a Saturday. Putting that silliness to one side, the request in the concept, the notion of a temporary restraining order, Judge, you don't have the time, we don't have the time, the parties don't have the time right now to stop this bad thing from happening. So enter a temporary, heavy emphasis on that, typically maybe 5 days, maybe days, could be even hours if you need to make it that limited, a temporary restraining order. The restraining part of it, the R of TRO, tell that party, in this case the government, to stop doing something. Tell them to keep their actions at bay. Tell them that the decision about the permanent injunction has not yet been entered. But while we can preserve the status quo so that there is not irreparable harm, we'll get back to that in just a moment or so. That's what these judges are doing because of the need for immediate action. The plane is taking off. USAID funds are no longer going overseas to help people who are starving. There is access to Social Security data that's going to compromise the safety and security of our nation's Social Security residents and citizens. There are people in our United States Army who are being prohibited from serving immediately. There are entities that have gotten huge numbers of monies to keep our climate safe. And all of that is in jeopardy right now. Enter a TRO, a temporary restraining order, Judge, and tell the government at least to stop doing what it's doing to enforce those executive orders so that we can come back in once again and ensure that you, Judge, and all the parties and the public, federal courts are public entities, that the judge can have a full and complete understanding of the merits on both sides. And oh, by the way, to the extent that a TRO, sometimes it's yes, indeed, sometimes it's ex parte, which means that the judge is hearing this because it's in such an emergency basis without the other side there. And that may strike many people as without due process. It is necessary from time to time. We'll talk more about how a TRO gets entered and what happens after a temporary restraining order is entered by a judge to stop the thing from happening immediately. And what happens after that? And what are these judges doing right now in our federal courts in the United States of America? Stay with us here on Amicus, a Law Review. Thank you.
This is Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. President Trump told reporters Friday there's no risk in his decision to dissolve the Department of Education, which still must be approved by Congress. He said the Department of Health and Human Services would handle special needs programs and nutritional programs, and the Small Business Administration would handle student loans.
All we have to do is get the students to get guidance from the people that love them and cherish them, including their parents. By the way, he'll be totally involved in their education along with the boards.
He also told the reporters he did not sign the order that invoked the Alien Enemies Act, allowing several hundred suspected gang members to be deported without hearings. But the president's signature is on the document that's in the Federal Register. George Foreman died Friday at 76. He regained the world heavyweight boxing title at 45 before making millions selling electric grills. And the Vatican says Pope Francis will appear Sunday from the Rome hospital where he's been treated for over a month. This is ABC News.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Badgers basketball tonight. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. It's Wisconsin against the Brigham Young Cougars. Tonight in the NCAA basketball tournament, Badgers head coach Greg Gard asked what team in the Big Ten reminds him of BYU.
Ourselves, for one. Illinois, a little bit. Illinois shoots a lot of threes. I think BYU may have even more shooters than Illinois. Obviously, for any team that's playing right now is really good.
The tip-off at 6:25. Marquette's season is over. The Golden Eagles lost to New Mexico by 9, 75-66. Head coach Shaka Smart on letting the game slip away.
When we took the lead in the second half, we could really feel a level of momentum. We weren't able to win that next swing minute and just some mistakes that cost us on both ends of the floor.
In hockey, the Wisconsin Badgers women's hockey team skated to a 6-2 win over Minnesota last night. They'll face Ohio State tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock for the national championship in Minneapolis. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Wherever you are in Wisconsin, there's a free and confidential Aging and Disability Resource Center, ADRC, or Tribal Partner Agency. We're here for older adults, adults with disabilities.
I'm meteorologist Brandon Bormans. A nice start to the weekend, bit of a different finish though. Sunny skies today with a high near 41. For tonight, increasing clouds, a light mix possible late, a low near 32. Rainy and breezy on Sunday with a high temperature near 50. Currently, it's 29.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. A Washington state audit of rejected 2020 mail-in ballots offers insight on whose ballots are more likely to be rejected and recommends actions to reduce that number, over 37,000 in 2024. Primary reasons for rejection include ballots received or postmarked after Election Day, a missing signature on a ballot envelope, or the voter's signature couldn't be confirmed. Auditors found 2020 rates varied from a high of 1.5% in Franklin County to 0.02% in Columbia County, but they also found higher rejections of younger voters, 18 to 21, where 2.6% of ballots were rejected, and black voters at 2.5%. They also found that non-native English speakers were 47% more likely to have ballots rejected. Signature issues can often be cured, but many voters don't or can't correct it. The auditors recommended outreach programs on college campuses, sending letters and calling voters with curable signature issues, more training on signature verification, opening early voting centers 18 days before the election, an advisory committee for disabled voters, and ballot drop boxes for every 15,000 voters. In the 2024 general election, Washington's statewide rejection rate had dropped to 0.94%, but of those, over 24,000 were rejected for a mismatched signature. Find a link to the audit at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org.
The Dom Salvia Show.
Musk is so arrogant that he is even intervening right here in the state of Wisconsin.
Republican Rep. Brian Stile said in a statement that Sanders was on a fear-mongering tour. Maybe you should be afraid when billionaires can buy the presidency, when billionaires can buy elections. I think that's a little scary. And
I think so.
We the people should do something about it.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Angela Lang from Block is my guest co-host for the day. We have news and this shouldn't be a thing. So join us.
Matinair on air. Weekday mornings at 11.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I'm your host this hour and next hour as well, along with Max, my producer, taking your phone calls, taking your comments at 855-752-4842. As we do a little law school this weekend, talking about injunctive relief, I-N-J-U-C-T-I-V-E, an injunction, technically meaning to stop something from happening, but could also mean compelling a party to do something, telling them to stop not doing something, the double negative there. And that's what's going on right now, as all of these private parties sometimes could be other parties coming into court, asking judges generally, it happens all the time in state and federal courts, coming into those courts and asking a judge to stop something from happening, stop something that is bad, that presumably would be the position of the challenger. Obviously, the other side would say, no, nothing bad happening here at all. You don't need to enter any injunction at all. And that's where we get the contest in at least these five cases. Many, many other circumstances out there in which this issue of injunctions, injunctive relief, and yes, indeed, TROs is at play today. So how does this work? You file your civil complaint. You go into the clerk's office, file that complaint. You set forth the basis for your allegation. And no, it is not the case that a judge will automatically just get out her or his stamp and say the TRO is granted. I'm stopping the party on the receiving end of this civil litigation from doing what it has been doing. Judges do have an absolute obligation to do a first level and sometimes even in-depth review, even at the TRO level, before they issue a temporary restraining order. It is an order of the court. Yes, indeed, it's important to understand, contrary to what our government has been saying recently, contrary to what the Department of Justice has been saying recently, that if a judge says something from the bench, what she or he says is the law. It is the order. Yes, it's often codified after that in a piece of paper, a written document in which the words are set forth in clear language. But the order comes out and it is effective at the time of the judge articulating that order. That's very important when it comes to this Venezuelan immigrant case and Judge Boasberg in particular. That's happened. That happens then that when the judge scheduled this on for a temporary restraining order hearing, if it is so urgent in time, can happen ex parte. That means without the other party present. Judges typically don't like to do that because they like to hear from everybody, at least at the start of the process, sometimes not necessary. If indeed the building is on fire, the dam is about to break, something else is about to happen that cannot be prevented. You cannot call. Don't have quite literally hours to take care of ensuring that there is a full exposition. That's the reason why it's temporary. The judge will say, you know what? It appears to me that there may be a basis for doing this. And yes, indeed, there are times when TROs are not granted because the judge can see facially there's no claim to relief here. We'll get back to the standards about this in just a moment or so. But if a TRO is entered, if the judge says, yes, I'm temporarily restraining this party from doing something, he or she will almost always say, and we're going to have a next hearing. Because of the temporary part of this, let me get you all into court. I'm going to make certain the other side knows all about this. We're going to get you back into court, typically within sometimes hours, most often days, sometimes weeks, so that's spreading a little bit thin. And at that time, we're going to have a fuller hearing, a more robust hearing on the merits of your claim, challengers. And yes, I'm also going to entertain the position of the opposing parties on why that opposing party thinks that the challenging party is wrong. I'm going to listen to all of that. I may take some testimony. I may hear about the law under which the particular temporary restraining order, under which the preliminary injunction is sought. We're going to argue about that. We're going to get testimony, evidence. I'm going to do a hearing in the nature of a trial, the kinds of things that you would otherwise see on television. Not exactly like that, of course, but that kind of proceeding where indeed you get into the weeds of a particular challenge. That's what happens at a preliminary injunction hearing. Those are the kinds of things that the judges are ordering right now after the TRO is in place. It does compel the TRO, the party that's opposing the challengers, not to continue what it's doing until the time of the preliminary injunction. And at that time, the judges then have a question to ask and to be answered by the parties and ultimately by them. And that is,
What are the standards? What should we do here? What are the standards under which we should turn this temporary restraining order into a preliminary injunction, maybe ultimately a permanent injunction? Maybe that would be a trial down the road, maybe weeks, maybe months down the road. What are the standards that are applied in federal court and also in state courts when those injunctive orders, those injunctive requests are reviewed? Here they are. Is there some risk of irreparable harm absent intervention? Again, it's injunction. It's preliminary. It's temporary. What happens if indeed the courts do not intervene to stop something from happening? Is there and can there be identified a clear risk of what's called irreparable harm? Money generally is not that. Just because you're going to lose money typically can sometimes, but typically does not support a finding of irreparable harm. But the notion, once again, is if indeed monies are not given to an overseas group that is going to be otherwise not providing those monies for a group of a population somewhere that's starving, if indeed the information provided in the public domain, or at least given to the Musk team, compromises safety and security of that information, once that is done, you can't bring the cows and the horses back into the barn, right? There is irreparable harm, and so the risk of the irreparable harm has to be identified. If you don't do this right now, there will be damages, and you can't recover that down the road simply by paying someone money. The harm is much beyond money. That's the risk of irreparable harm, absence of intervention. And then there's another aspect of this, which I also mentioned just in passing, and that is this. There's got to be some proof of a likelihood of success on the merits. The challenging party, the petitioner, the plaintiff, has got to come in and say, you know what? Not only is there irreparable harm, but probably when we get to that final trial, that final request for a permanent injunction down the road, there is a good indication, a pretty solid indication right now, that I, the party seeking this injunctive relief, have a likelihood of being successful on the underlying merits. When we go to trial, I'll be able to prove to a judge, to a jury, that indeed there has been harm here, that something needs to be stopped permanently, and that the merits of what I'm saying are supported by the Constitution, by a piece of legislation, by a statute, by a regulation, by something that gives me a right to come into court. That's called the likelihood of success on the merits. And implicit in all of this, once again, is that money damages are simply not adequate. If money damages could restore someone to their position before the particular order or government action was taken, then you wouldn't need a TRO, right? Because ultimately you can simply give that person whatever the damages, the money damages would be, and make them whole. That's the point. Money will not make them whole if indeed these things are permitted to go ahead, because money simply will not restore a job, will not restore overseas help, will not restore the environment that is compromised by virtue of not going ahead with grants. Millions of dollars of grants to keep our air clean, our waters clean as well. You can't call that back and say simply money will take care of it. That's what injunctive relief is all about. And that's what's going on. And why do I do all that? Why are we doing this examination, this law school course on injunctive relief? Because it's what's going on in all of these instances, which we're now going to talk about as well. In each one of these, and this is also to push back on that notion which my president has talked about, which my attorney general has talked about, that somehow these are judges that are running roughshod over process. They are not. They're following what the injunctive policies and processes and practical implications have been, candidly, for a very long time. Risk of irreparable harm, absent intervention, likelihood of success on the merits, the idea that judges will schedule these things on, take evidence, make determinations ultimately not based upon some knee-jerk reaction, not based upon political animation at all, but based upon what's happening in court. That is the injunctive relief process. That is the function of the federal courts, and they do it all the time in these circumstances, happen to be focused a lot upon what our president, my president, is doing these days, issuing these executive orders, and that's where we're going to get to them right now. Before we do, however, we already have some callers online. We appreciate so much, as we get into these particular cases, your comments, your questions. And let's begin with Brian. Brian, we appreciate your call coming into our program this weekend.
Yeah, just a quick, well, few questions.
And sure.
Talking to each other. With everything that Musk is doing with these $100 buyouts, you know, for votes for the Supreme Court, a lot of people are saying that what he's doing is illegal. How can that be stopped? And then the other thing is I've heard from other people that if you take the buyout, that's illegal too. Where do we stand on that?
Right, know? Right. A lot less. Again, this is another issue that, again, who knows? Somebody may go into court and try to stop this from happening here. I think it's important to understand what is and is not proper. Plainly, this is not voting, right? If we know, in fact, that the Voting Rights Act says that if you pay somebody to vote in a certain way, that's in violation of the law. The Voting Rights Act in the 1960s, that prohibited that. That's not this. That's not what's going on. What Elon Musk is doing and his team out there is doing is giving you $100 if you'll sign on to a document that condemns these so-called activist judges, that talks about the judiciary in a way that again, he and others have a right to talk about the judiciary as they want. That's a part of our First Amendment privilege and our rights. The concern, I think, that an awful lot of people have is that it may not be illegal in the literal sense of the word. It doesn't appear to be a violation of the Voting Rights Act. You're not buying votes. You're asking people to sign up on a piece of paper, an agenda item, a statement that they apparently believe that we've got activist judges who should be stopped somehow. It is concerning. And Brian, I think this is why what animates your call, which is that if people really believe that there should be a petition, if there should be this statement that I can sign on to, I should believe that and I should be able to petition in some way, regardless of how that petition might be used. We don't know where that's going exactly. I should be able to do that without being compelled to, or at least even encouraged to do it by virtue of being paid to do it. $100 and I write my name on this. Am I really committed to the statements in that petition? That's, I think, a lot of the question. It's not so much a buyout as it is a buy-off, if you will, for doing exactly that. And that's the concern there. If indeed at some point, whether it's politically or in the judicial process, the results of this process are brought into the courts, then judges have an obligation to take a look at whether or not these particular statements on these petitions are in fact legitimate. If indeed people were simply paid off to sign their names to it, as you can tell, I have great skepticism about it. We have got a country where, yes, indeed, you can speak about judges. You can be critical of judges. Our attorney general should be balanced about that. But others can object to the findings, to the decisions that they make without attacking the very integrity of the process. And that's where this system and this particular issue, as it percolates up, becomes more and more problematic. But Brian, appreciate the call tremendously. We'll plainly hear from this again, and it's much related to what we're talking about this morning on our broadcast. We also have Mark calling in. Mark, appreciate your comment or your question this morning as well.
Yeah, I certainly think that the deportation of those Venezuelans to El Salvador is pretty clearly a violation of the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution. I mean, I guess you could stretch it and say, well, they posed a public danger, but there's nothing the ordinary legal process could handle those people, to actually arrest them and indict them and, to have them, they have a right as persons, they have a right under a constitution to a trial and not just scooped up, because anybody could get scooped up like this. And, you know, with the president just says, those are my enemies, and scoop them up and
send them off,
with the Constitution,
right? Exactly. Yeah.
And as far as for this whole immunity for the president thing, is that the president's official duties. I mean, the Supreme Court said in the course of his, applying his official duties. Well, one of his official's duties is to faithfully execute the law.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this particular law, which we're going to talk about, the Alien Enemies Act, you've got it just right. When we come back, we're going to talk more about, Mark, your very points having to do with process and having to do with the injunction that the judge attempted to impose a week ago. All of that coming up as we talk more about those Venezuelan immigrants. Mark, appreciate the comment, the call here on Amicus, a Law Review.
A voice for Madison. Real news and great conversation. 92.7 WMDX.
People have always trusted a compass. Now it's your turn. Hi, I'm with the Aaron Weber Group. And yes, I got a compass in my hand.
Aye, matey. A compass guides me to treasure.
I'm Magellan, and a compass got me around the world.
Aye, 'tis true.
Throughout history, a compass has been trusted to lead the way. Now, let the Aaron Weber Group and Compass, the number one real estate brokerage in the country, guide you home. The Aaron Weber Group, powered by Compass, at movedmadison.com.
Our real estate riches await.
You can support animals in need in our community when you shop at Dane County Humane Society's thrift stores. Thrift Store West on Watts Road and Thrift Store East on High Crossing Boulevard. Shop gently used and new clothing and accessories, home goods, toys, furniture, and a whole lot more. All proceeds from the Dane County Humane Society's thrift stores support the comfort and care of animals in need across the county. Visit giveshelter.org/thrift for more information.
A new choice. Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
This is Amicus. My name is Jim Santel. We are initiating with this broadcast, this hour, next hour, a new segment. Perhaps it will last, perhaps it won't. We'll see what history brings, called Injunction Function, talking about the function of federal judges in enjoining actions of the president, and they're doing it across the board. We're going to highlight five of them to greater and lesser degrees in this broadcast. Continuing down the road, we necessarily will not be able to address every single one of these, but important to understand what's going on. Important in the wake of Mark's good comment just before the break, talking about the mechanisms by which a president can also be held to account for the things that he, perhaps one day she, does under the law, invoking one of my very favorite aspects of our Constitution, as Mark did, the Take Care Clause. So the president's got an obligation to take care that the laws of our nation be faithfully executed. Well, what's this law all about? It's called the Alien Enemies Act. The Alien Enemies Act, and right now it's before a judge named James Boasberg. He is the chief judge of the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia, and we know what this is all about. We know that a week ago, this weekend, the judge was first addressed by petitioners who were very concerned about decisions made by our government to put on three different planes a number of people identified as Venezuelan immigrants, identified by the Justice Department, by the government, as Venezuelan gang members that apparently are part of a group called the Tren de Aragua. And based upon that, they were pushed on these planes and moved off our nation, brought to El Salvador. And to this day, a week later, now they're in a high security prison there in El Salvador, plainly outside of our nation now. And what happens is that the petitioners come in front of Judge Boasberg and say, stop those planes from taking off. Stop that from happening because, as Mark just indicated, these particular individuals, regardless of who they are, we don't know immediately who they are, they have not had their right to due process under the law. And indeed, Judge Boasberg issues one of these temporary restraining orders. He says, yes, ground those planes, keep them in place. Do not do this until we can have a full and fair hearing on what's happening here. And we know factually what happened. Again, unclear to this day about exactly what the timing of this is, which is the reason why Judge Boasberg is very, very angry these days about not being able to get a straight answer. But apparently, almost contemporaneous with the judge's decision to ground those planes, the planes are in fact in the air. And the question is, did he speak? Did he prohibit those planes from taking off before they did? Or was that order issued after they were already in the air? And was there any attempt even to call them back? And so the judge, in the wake of that initial TRO that he issued that said, keep the planes on the ground or bring them back, has asked the government, the U.S. Department of Justice, your government, to answer some five simple questions about when the planes left, who's on the planes, those kinds of things. He is asking for information about what happened here. And he issued that TRO, and for the past week has had a number of hearings, including some just late as Friday, some on Monday, repeatedly postponing an opportunity at the request of the government to be heard on this matter. The Department of Justice saying, we're not yet ready, we don't have the information yet. And the judge exhibiting a huge amount of patience after initially saying, yes, I need this information right now to determine whether or not, number one, the government is in contempt of my order for failing to abide by it. That's the larger rule of law issue. And secondarily, getting to the merits, what about this Alien Enemies Act? Does the government have the right to do this in the first place? Does the president have the right to do this under that old law that basically is applicable when, in fact, we're in a time of war? We'll talk more about that in just a moment or so. Those are the questions in front of Judge Boasberg. So on Thursday, the judge basically said that he is inching toward holding the government in contempt for possibly violating his ruling, pausing the deportation of those Venezuelans under this rarely invoked wartime statute in a very sternly written order. And that's the other lesson from all of these cases. You've got judges who are not responding in a very docile way. They are saying, no, indeed, executive branch, you are violating the law, and don't you dare think about violating my orders. Sternly written order, very, very clear on this. He told the administration to explain to him, by next Tuesday, we've got a few more days. He's already given them lots of extensions. They've asked for them. They've submitted other things along the way. He has called the information provided by the government to this point, by your government, as woefully insufficient, his words, not mine, when it comes to answering his questions about what happened here. He's given them until Tuesday to show him, and what's called an order to show cause, tell me why it is you have not violated my instructions when you allowed flights of these immigrants to continue to El Salvador, even after I, the judge, directed those planes to return to the United States. Boasberg called out the efforts by the Justice Department to repeatedly stonewall his attempts to get this information for the past several days about the timing of the flights over the weekend. He said this, the government again evaded its obligations. Those are words you don't want to hear if you're in the receiving end of those words. He added that the Justice Department, this is Pam Bondi's Justice Department, about the flights again, woefully insufficient. You're not responding to my inquiries here. Went on in later settings to say that the government has been intemperate and disrespectful. He talked about never before seeing this kind of language from a Department of Justice attacking a judge in this way. He issues a 3-page order. It's a remarkable display of frustration by a judge once again who has given Pam Bondi and the Department of Justice people an awful lot of rope here. He is seeking not only information about this, but also now asking about whether or not this extraordinary invocation of the Alien Enemies Act to pursue the Trump administration's immigration agenda, whether that is legitimate. The government has made these last-minute efforts to cancel the hearing before Judge Boasberg. They run up to the Court of Appeals, telling the Court of Appeals that the judge has no jurisdiction, which is simply wrong. Attempting to stop him from doing that. And of course, all of that leads to further animation. It also, in the midst of this, which we'll talk about later, is the genesis for this spat, this argument between the president who says, yes, indeed, Boasberg's got to be impeached. Got to be impeached, got to take him out of there because of what he's doing. The supporters of the president have assailed him as a hack a Marxist, a terrorist sympathizer. Donald Trump himself has entered this fray again, demanding impeachment of Judge Boasberg, prompting the Chief Justice to push back at least on that. He should have done more, but at least on that. When our broadcast continues, we'll talk more about the Venezuelan immigrants, where the case stands right now, and what the injunction function of this court is all about, pending there in the District of Columbia, here on Amicus, a Law Review.
Welcome to Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
T. Schwaba. On the next Nightlight, I welcome the director of a new documentary called A Road at Night, John Roach. And then actor Ezekiel Drews joins the show to talk about a fun new musical. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with P. Schwaba. Weeknights from 6 till 8. Winter is out and winning is in. It's our Break into Spring statewide text to win contest on your local Civic Media radio station. Your daily shot at a Chula Vista getaway, Milwaukee Brewers club level tickets, or $100 cash. And every entry gets you closer to the grand prize. A brand new Verlo Queen mattress set from Verlo and Madison, including a mattress, sheets, protector, and pillows. Download the Civic Media app from the App Store or Google Play Store. Choose your station, then get set to win starting Monday, March 24th. Get ready to break into spring with WMDX. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
This is 92.7 WMDX Columbus, Madison's home for real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. A federal judge called the Trump administration's use of the Alien Enemies Act to deport people with little or no due process incredibly troublesome, and said the arguments being presented about presidential powers were, quote, awfully frightening. That came during a Friday hearing, but also Friday, the president told the reporters,
I don't know when it was signed because I didn't sign it. Other people handled it, but Marco Rubio's done a great job, and he wanted him out, and we go along with that.
However, the president's signature is on that order in the Federal Register. Legendary boxer turned businessman George Foreman died at 76 from the Rumble in the Jungle to the George Foreman Grill. He was in the public spotlight for six decades. Israel struck Lebanon in retaliation for rockets targeting Israel, the heaviest exchange of fire since the November ceasefire. And Heathrow Airport once again fully operational after a fire at a power substation impacted travel plans of millions. This is ABC News.